Yesterday we had some discussion about Christianity in South Asia, and one of the things I mentioned that numerically we are a minority. I'm speaking mainly of Pakistan, Bangladesh, India and Sri Lanka. India has about 2.8% of its population as Christian, so it's a very minority numerically. So in the religious pluralist context, we face different religions in India and South Asia. India mainly Hinduism, 80% of our people are Hindus, so that is the main religious context. In Pakistan and Bangladesh is obvious, is Islam. In Sri Lanka it is Buddhism. Besides this, we have some other religions also, Jainism, which is also offshoot or reform movement from Hinduism, Zoroastrianism. We have Zoroastrianism mainly people from Persia who migrated and settled in India, and Sikhism. I think some of you may be familiar in the recent weeks that they are claiming their identity in India and wanting to have a separate state of their own, and they have printed their own currency notes and flags and things like that. And India also, we take political ideologies seriously. Today Marxism or socialism, they are not just for us something out there. They have also taken a religious shape, and we have to confront with them. And one of the another force which is really challenging Christianity and other religions is rationalist movement. There's a group called of rationalists, and they organize conventions, conferences. They challenge religious people and they challenge religious people doing miracles, and they ask them to come to the platform and do it. And that is also a kind of force we have to face. Now, briefly, I thought I'll give, as I said, my field is history, so I'm venturing into a new field. So briefly, I thought I will put down some of the important elements of Hinduism and then pick up from there how Christians see some of the things they can pick up from this, or how Christians develop their theology as a kind of a challenge or the reaction to this. Now, Hinduism, the approach are at least three, you can say. Philosophical Hinduism, where there will be pure philosophical discussions, and the concept which will be talked about is supreme being or power. They don't talk in terms of individual gods. Then we come to the popular level, where we have deities, and mainly it is mentioned as incarnation of this supreme being. At least except it is 10. So here we have Rama or Krishna, Krishna cult, which is very much popular. That comes under popular religion. Now, Hinduism also has, what it has done is in when it came to popular level, when Hinduism came to India through Aryans, as they spread towards throughout India, whichever popular deity they came across, they made it part of Hinduism. So all the popular deities were Hinduized in that sense, and except they couldn't Hinduize Jesus, which some attempts were made, or for that case Muhammad. That is the popular level. So popular level, you find a big temple and a deity there, and they all consider themselves Hindus, whether they worship Ganesh or Krishna or Rama, they're all still Hindus. Then animistic religion among mainly tribals, it is found, and most of the cases they worship their own ancestors, or it's a kind of a hero worship and tree or things like that. Again, Hinduism has a beautiful way of blending this inside, and they also say there's nothing wrong, you may find soul in the tree and there's life. So it is not homogeneous, there's various forms of it. But when it comes to practice, who is a Hindu, then can I be considered a Hindu? No. Then if you are a Hindu, these two things are very important, the practice and belief, which cuts across all these three levels. One strong belief is on the caste system. which is a practice which is practiced among Hindus. Even though discrimination because of caste system is illegal according to the constitution, that is very much practiced. Now we have four castes. The first one is priestly. It is, and they are also supposed to be think tanks of Hinduism. And they are the people who are benefited from education and things like that. They form a very small minority. I think maybe less than 10%. But they are the people who really control the situation. And then the rulers, but now we don't have any kings and queens, but they mainly came from that generation. Then traders and landlords, and then the laborers. Not all types of laborers, of some recognized laborers. And then comes the untouchables and the tribals, who do the menial job, and who, as I put in the picture, always they don't come into this picture, but somehow Hinduism, because of this approach, considers them also Hindus. So this is the... Now, what has happened is, caste in India is very much associated with class. So the rich class, the upper class, they come from mainly priestly and ruling class, and the scale goes down. So India, we are not just facing the class problem, which of course Marx and others have developed. We have a unique problem of caste class problem. This is, if you come to India and read any books on economics or things like that, the one of the things you come is caste class, because historically these people had the education, these people had all the benefits, and they are the ones who kept the accounts, they are the ones who said where the boundary line runs between properties and things like that, and they control the situation. All of our prime ministers except one was Brahmin. Indira Gandhi herself is a Brahmin. And as I told yesterday, this also cuts across Christianity. And they say one of the points where we are very indigenous is when the caste system comes in. This is true when people are appointed for bishopric. And yesterday I was sharing with the group, I don't know, some of you are here. We made a study about theological teachers, and most of them also comes from upper caste. Partly because they come from a background of educated people and well-to-do people. So in that sense, it cuts across the chest. Then belief. I think two strong beliefs are karma and rebirth. Karma is fate. I think this is partly to keep this caste system tight. You develop a theory of karma. And he says, you are born to your caste, you cannot change it. Now, as I told yesterday, within caste system, you see, this is a four big groups. Within that, there are about 300 to 500 subgroups. You see. Within Brahmins, also there runs about 50 different types and different classes. Now, what has happened is historically they moved from one group to another, one level to another within the caste group. Within, say, let us say rulers, there may be hierarchy, but they can mobilize themselves upward. And always the mobilization was through the picking up practices of Brahmin class, which is known as in India, they use a technical word called Sanskritization. So always a mobility, you move in your within your caste group by following the practice of Brahmins. So you try to become a vegetarian or some other practice and take up a learning and things like that. So there is no movement from one caste to another. So be a, the whole teaching is be obedient, be faithful within your caste group and serve the priestly class, and the next life you may be born into. After death, this is possible. I don't know how, but that is how it is. And rebirth is the very key concept which is dominating Indian mind. Rebirth or reincarnation is the very key concept, because in order to get out of karma, see, you have to have, if you are karma, you have to have rebirth. Otherwise, that may be questioned. Now, this is the one aspect which is, I hope I'll remember to mention, there has been a thesis by a Christian about the rebirth concept, and the rebirth concept has to come into Christian theology. We'll pick it up later. Now, when it comes to philosophical level, as I said, in a philosophical level, they will talk mainly of Supreme Being, and then the major teaching comes, Supreme Being is one, or zero, whatever it may be, if you can't put in a numerical form. And there are many ways to that one, ultimate one, the ultimate being. This is where no other philosophical system can have a crusade towards Hinduism, or they cannot really challenge. They will say, after all, fine, your system, after all, it is leading to the same being, so let us be friends, let us coexist. And now, this many ways have been defined differently by philosophers. Now, there are, I think, three dominant philosophical teaching is how this happens is non-dualism, dualism, and qualified dualism. This is a kind of salvation, how we say. Now, non-dualism is, I don't think it is that popular now, but philosophically still holding a very strong control over certain sections of intellectuals. Now, one of the examples they give is snake and rope. Since there's only one reality, all other things what we see is not real. So it's like seeing a rope and believing it is snake. Actually, it's just a rope. So the whole salvation is when a person realizes that he or she is God. That is the point of salvation. Because there is no dualism. There's one reality. We are all part of that reality, only we have to realize. Until that realization, no, the rebirth cycle takes place. And there's another system, it's called dualism. They say, we have to refine it a little more. It's like a pile of stones. You know, if you take that reality as a pile of stones, we are just one. And when we find that identity, salvation comes. Qualified dualism has some mix-up, but I just put down there. Now, as far as theories of salvation, how it operates between God and person relationship, it has been defined by different people in different way, but I think two are dominant. One is monkey and other is cat approach. Can you say what it is? It is monkey approach is, you see, the baby of the monkey grabs the mother monkey. So it is the approach from you towards God. Whereas the cat approach is, the cat is the one which takes a kitten and carries it and places wherever it. So, here also, it can have a lot of implications for doing our own theology if we want to reach to our Hindu brothers and sisters. This is one of the dominant theories, either monkey or cat approach. Now, one of the things which has played very important role in the recent years, see, we have Vedas, Puranas, and various literatures of religious literature. Bhagavad Gita. It's a small book. It's a discourse of Krishna and Arjuna, one of the princes during the war between two tribes. And Krishna is the main teacher here. And one of the things talks about in the book is Nishkama Karma, means non-attachment. You do a duty because you are bound to do a duty without any desire for reward. And that is the one book which really motivated Gandhi, and Gandhi also felt this is the same teaching he finds in Jesus. It's selfless kind of approach to life, and one does the duty because the person is called to do that duty. That book is almost, I think, as big as St. John's Gospel. It's not a big book, but that is playing a very important role, and many religious leaders at present have written commentaries. As we have commentaries from different perspectives in our New Testament or Old Testament books, you can find many commentaries on this. Now, other important religion which plays a very important role in India is Islam. As I mentioned yesterday, we are more Muslims in India than in Pakistan. So it is just a political decision by British to have a separate land for Muslims. I mean, I think we are the second largest Muslim population in the world, I think, after Indonesia. I have to check that. But we have more Muslims in India than Pakistan. Now, the problem with them, there are many similarities, but also there are many things which divide us. One thing is monotheism, And they also, when we all talk, there is one God. Then the problem starts. Then when they stop with one, we say in three person, that's the problem comes. And they cannot understand how we say one God, and then also we affirm our belief in Trinity. And this has become a big problem in our own dialogue. And then the whole question of Jesus, place of Jesus. And they say, you have done very well from Old Testament, you have moved and you have seen what Jesus has done. Now why you want to stop there? You have to come forward and see Muhammad after Muhammad. But we want to stop there. So they say, you have done your journey only halfway, please follow us. And one other thing is brotherhood or sisterhood that is very strong. And of course they have their own divisions. But again and again they point out against the denominations. They have their own denominations also. Denominations say against us and our constant divisions. This has become a problem to them. And one of the key issues where dialogue really takes a hard shape is, for them, they don't make a difference between politics and religion. See, if religion is something, belief in supreme being, and which has to cut through our life in every aspect of life, how can you say politics has nothing to do with religion? So you cannot have politics if you are a Muslim. Your beliefs and your practices have to cut through politics. Now for Christians, we always have this church and state division, so that creates a certain amount of problem. Now, how about 10 minutes, how... Now, I don't want to go on explaining Buddhism. I think one of the great things about Buddhism and Jainism is respect for life. I think non-violence is the key word. And so human beings simply don't have a right to do anything with the nature as they like, or even with the animal kingdom or rest of the life. Jainism takes the same line. Whereas Sikhism, when it comes, Sikhism again emphasizes equality and brotherhood and sisterhood. That again challenges us, how can you be Christians and divided and also practice caste system. This is especially in Indian context. Now, Christianity faced this from the beginning. As I told you, Christianity came to India in the 1st century. Now, 1st century Christians mainly came from Syria. And is part of the Eastern Church. Now, as soon as they came, they started moving in the privileged class, in upper class and Brahmin class. And the Syrians, because they are foreigners, they were also given a status by the kings that they match equally with the upper caste. And they were very happy with that and they stayed with that. And there was no missionary activities from the Syrian church to other parts of India. They came to Kerala and they stayed. Even today, in the Syrian Orthodox Church, there are only Kerala people, there are no people from rest of India. Now, then comes in 16th century the Roman Catholic Church. As I told you, one of the difficulties we faced, they came with the political power. Now, one of the earliest pioneers was Robert de Nobili. An Italian Catholic priest. Now, when they came, you see, they struggled with this issue. You see, caste system was so strong. Now, what should we do? Should we break through the caste? And some missionaries felt, yes, we should break through the caste. But some missionaries felt, no, this system is there. We should work within the system. And Robert de Nobili is one of the person who early tried to mainly have a mission to Brahmins. He said, if you have to win Indians like Paul, you have to be Romans to the Romans, or you adapt to the culture. So he wanted to be a Brahmin, and he gave up his cassock and adopted a Brahmin dress, including a thread which Brahmins put. But he had his own interpretation. He had a thread with three threads representing the Trinity and all sorts of things. And he didn't go out to preach. He just built a small house or a small shed and he just sat there. The whole Hindu religious tradition is, if you are enlightened one, you just sit there and people just come and for discourse. And he took up vegetarianism and he had a Brahmin to cook for him. The whole approach is you have to become an Indian or a Brahmin to become, and this was severely opposed by Rome, and he was pushed away. Now, not much attempts have been done from that side. Then, as I told you, there's an Indian Renaissance which takes place in the 19th century, which is a crucial period for forming Indian Christian theology, or for that matter, 19th century. We were together. There was no separate Sri Lanka country or Pakistan country. We are South Asian. Now, Indian Renaissance is due to the English education, and also Hindus are trying to go back to their own traditions. A lot of Indian scriptures have been translated to English language, and many of the Hindus started studying their own religions. And they started saying, now whatever Christianity says is already there. So now what we have to do is, only thing we have to do is interpret Christianity from the Hindu point of view. And many people have taken the challenge, and they said, as a early Christianity has been embedded or interpreted through Aristotelian philosophy, why can't we take Indian philosophy to interpret Christianity? And this attempt has been, the beautiful thing about it, both Hindus and some early Christians made this attempt. Hindus, they remained as a Hindus, but wrote on theology, Christian theology, from their own perspective. And we are bringing out some of this book out, like mainly this is Brahma Samaj, I don't know whether it makes any sense, or Arya Samaj, which is a sort of reformed Hindu group. And they wrote on Jesus and how they understood Jesus and incarnation and salvation from their own point of view. But it's a very, very small group. And again, the educated Christian class, they also started their own approach. Now, approach has been, I think one approach they made is, see, approach is either through knowledge, or you can through work, or through devotion. Now, different people have taken different gospels and tried to understand Jesus from different. So, some went on interpreting Jesus and his gospel as the one who brings the knowledge, enlightenment. Some went on enlightenment and mysticism, and St. John's gospel is the gospel for this kind of thing. And some others, karma, I see. Luke's gospel is a miracle and other things that you really, or the bhakti tradition. These are the three traditions through which they try to develop their own system. Again, this is among a very, very small group, and this is the beginning of Indian Christian theology, which remained as a very much a small part of it. And there has been a big dialogue, and through that, the whole dialogue movement starts out. Then some people, I think the basis of this Indian Christian theology is to develop it from our own context. But at that time, the religious context. The other attempts were to create Indian church. They said, many of them said, when you go and read the India, the Christian scriptures, the Bible, we see a lot of contradiction as we see the Christianity which is brought to India. So we go back to the scriptures and develop a model of the church, a koinonia, or ecclesia, taking the Indian context. And there are churches in the name of Indian church which has been started. But again, see, these were sort of considered eccentric people or some odd people. Attempts were made, Indian church has been started, and there are movements which have been started which very much remained outside. And I think the greatest breakthrough is in our experiment in worship, which is being carried on even today. Now, worship, and one of the things they said, now we are being introduced Western liturgy, Western hymns, but why can't we develop our own hymns, our lyrics, and use our own instruments? Say, there was a time about 50 years back, you can't use any Indian instruments in the church because they were considered as connected with Hinduism, so heathen. Whereas organ and things were the heavenly instrument. Not only even organ, among Western instruments also, guitar, you couldn't bring the guitar inside the church, I think, which is slowly changing. So it starts to be organ or the violin and brass instruments because of German influence. But many people said, no, we have to go back for Indian instrument. And building churches, they adopted the Indian architecture style, and churches have been built. And they also said now, we should also start ashramas. See, ashramas is one of the biggest things of Mahatma Gandhi, going back to the roots. It's a religious community. So all these experiments should, religious community should be the center of Christianity. And many of these experiments were taken place in these places. And then the whole area of scripture, no, approach to scripture. I think here I would cite one or two extreme cases, and I think then we'll come back. Now, first approach was to pick up for reading, when the lessons are read, pick up from other scriptures. If we believe that all truth comes from God, whom we also worship and believe, then if there is something good in Hindu scripture, it has to come from that one God, who we confess as Father of Jesus Christ. So why can't we read from Hindu scriptures? Why can't we use text from Quran? And this has been introduced by a small group. And then there has been a big discussion about place of Old Testament. I think this also, again I'm saying this is not the general pattern of thinking, it's again the small experiment which has done. And many people went to the extent that as OT was important for Judeo-Christianity, we should take Vedas or Puranas for Indian Christianity. Because the leading God's leading movement or God's work leading people to salvation has been fulfilled, seen in through the community of Israel and fulfilled with Jesus Christ. And same type of movement we see in Indian scriptures. Now, again, they don't want to make every scripture, Indian scripture, to Hindu scriptures. So why can't it be replaced by Hindu scriptures through dialogue? And you can understand how the reaction will be, it's a kind of, because we are still working in a Judeo-Christian framework. Now about Jesus Christ himself, there have been a big debate, and the debate also is in the West, Jesus of history and Christ of faith. Now actually, if you take, now Jesus for all practical purpose is a Jew, in that sense, alien to Indian situation, we can't say Asian situation if we take Israel. And Christ is historical experiment in theology as well as in worship, picking up some of the words. Jnana Marga or Sanskrit words, and also introducing the whole worship through the Hindu traditional setup. Now, recently we are facing. We have come through this journey. Now, what had happened is, unconsciously, all these experiments were done by a small group of people, literate, coming from upper caste, and most of them belonging to Brahmin group. Because they came with a very strong identity, a strong philosophical background, strong tradition, and they want to make this attempt. So now as we sit down and reflect on this, one of the things we found out, all these attempts, the philosophical system and worship models, we have taken from the dominant culture, the Brahmin culture, which is the culture of less than 10%. This is partly because this is the only system
which was available in writing, and which was made to believe that is the system of whole of India. But now we are, whereas if you take Indian Christianity, for that matter, Christianity in the whole Indian subcontinent, at least 75%, if not 80%, they don't come from that culture. So what I tried to say in the beginning is happening here. As the groups within a caste system trying to have upper mobilization by adopting the Brahmin system and culture, unconsciously or consciously this has happened in the process of indigenization in India. Many of my friends totally disagree with this because filtered and refined kind of philosophy and system, you should go for it. But now there's a big another movement called People's Theology. People's Theology is another big thing. They said what we should be worried about, the customs and traditions of these people, not the philosophical system of 10%, and through that we have to express ourselves. So maybe you have to see Jesus as a kind of a woodcutter. If that tradition is Dan, it's a kind of a from another system which comes from Brahmin, a teacher. A guru will not be equivalent to, see, we have various titles for Jesus Christ. So instead of taking a Brahmin system and saying Jesus is a guru, which is very much used, maybe we have to take what is the tradition of these people and see Jesus as entirely different. Maybe a woodcutter or a farmer or these kind of, I'm just giving a... So people theology is becoming very important, but the problem is we don't have these, their thoughts and traditions in written form. So we have to go back to the oral tradition and so find out these through the folklores, folk tales. Now that is a big thing in Indian theology. For that matter, whole of not only South Asia, Southeast Asia also. Going back to the folk tales, folklores, the oral tradition, and find out what is a tradition and build up theology or express theology in that. I think I'll stop here. I mentioned that I'll just mention a rebirth. A friend of mine, I said this used to be the biggest issue for some groups within Christians. If salvation is only through Jesus Christ, what you'll say those who are born prior to the incarnation? This debate was there for many, many years. And this person, he's Dr. Vasanjatana, he worked under Hendrik Ott at Basel. He developed a thesis that Christians, Indian Christians, have to really take up rebirth seriously. And somehow, very roughly, his conclusion is, I think that is a stronger way of saying, if we believe salvation is only through Jesus Christ, and then you adopt this rebirth concept, then there's no problem of what happened to those people who are born prior to the incarnation. So in a way, everybody... that's a hard kind of thing. He has written a beautiful thesis. I'm not really representing what he has said. And in fact, he stood first in the whole of university, not just in the theology department. He has done a beautiful thesis. I can give the title. His name is Vasanjatana. Now these are some of the experiments which are being carried out, but again this touches only a very small section of people. But Indian Christian theology is the one thing which is slowly coming up. Now this is not done because some of our people just sitting and just romanticizing all these things. All this has come because in our day-to-day life, we are facing people who think differently and who have a different tradition and constantly ask questions to us to clarify a situation. And in that dialogue and is that leaving some of these things. I think I'll just stop here.
Henry, I'd like to hear more about people's theology. Is it a movement that one can identify as a beginning point? What was the character of it getting started? Does the worship look considerably different, etc. I'd just like to hear some more.
See, I think people's theology mainly emerged out of what we call the action group, Christian action groups. And their whole, of course, this whole practice theology or contextual theology.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, these things have to emerge from our experience and the experience of people who are struggling to be human. And this is the whole I think the main background is these action groups who are involved and who have got a new experience of what it is to be human and what it is to be struggling for humanity for whom it is completely divine. Denied than just saying that once you become Christian, then you are saved, everything is all right. So, I don't know whether I'm...
Is it then a movement within the church?
Yeah, it's within the church, and one of the institutions which has taken off very seriously is Christian Institute for Study of Religion and Society, which was headed by M.M. Thomas and now other people. So the whole idea is theologists emerge from below. It's no more that theology very set pattern and then it has to apply.
That's so fascinating, like the methodology of Latin America and so forth. I mean, has there been much interplay back and forth? Do the literature out of Latin America, is that something that is read in India, or did this emerge quite independently? What kind of connections have come there?
It has emerged quite independently. One of the criticisms we had, our people had about Latin American theology, they have taken the economics seriously, and the whole thing has been built on it. It may not be a true kind of criticism, but that becomes a key factor. Whereas in India, they say the religious factor is very key factor because our economic problem is very much tied up with our religious concepts, right, like caste. It's a caste class system. Whereas they are struggling with the class system. For us, the caste class system becomes very important, and caste is tied up with the whole religious thinking. And also, I don't know, correct me. We are living in a very pluralistic type of, even religious thing is not similar. Whereas we see their system is more homogeneous.
Yes, they have a whole Catholic culture. Yeah.
And again, some other criticism is that Latin American system again is within the broad framework of Western theology. Whereas our struggle is supposed to be different.
Does people's theology cross caste class lines? Do you get, for example, leadership from other one class and more than others or not?
You see, they are very conscious of this caste class system which is operating consciously, unconsciously. But leadership at present comes from upper caste Christians, I mean educated and things like that. But they are very conscious, very sensitive about it. And they still feel they are more of a, what you use the word, they are there to facilitators, but they are not the people. You see, they are not there to experiment something and write theology.
Mm-hmm.
They are just there to facilitate so that theology will emerge and these people themselves will utter it. And one of the things how these people started expressing is what you call street drama. That is one of the powerful things, you see, because you not only listen, but you just feel it and you enter the situation. And many of our conferences, I don't think we have done when Faith and Order was there, it was just in the early stage. But we have Christian Conference of Asia and some meeting, assembly meeting and some other meetings. This is one of the things, and it is done even in the worship. You see, they also come with entirely different type of worship service. Not the indigenous, the historical indigenous in that sense. Theirs is entirely different. We had 25th anniversary of Christian Institute for Study of Religion and Society. We had few members from World Council of Churches, including General Secretary Philip Potter and all that. And they were all there in their dress, and these people come in, and there's not even a change of dress and all that. They come in their own dress from their own slum area and enact. And really challenge people, and bring in their own music. See, again, when we adopted music, most of us, we adopted classical Indian music, which is not the music of 70 to 80%.
I wish you could talk a little more on that, the degree of indigenization and worship and so forth. When I was at the Faith and Order conference in Bangalore, we all got sent out and sent to preach, you know, around it. And I, for reasons that escaped me, was assigned to go to what had been the Anglican Cathedral. And it was a shattering experience. It was a little bit of old England, you know. I mean, it was more British than anything I'd ever had in a sabbatical year in Oxford. And I was really staggered that so much of the Western mode, not only of the order of worship, but the music and so forth, it was as though one had been in some place in Britain. Is that very common, or is that kind of exception? Is the indigenous music and so forth, has that really made its way in, or is it still a fight?
It's very dominant, and especially among educated and city class, the city churches, mainly cathedrals. They are the last place to change. And you see, but recently, just before I came here, we had a Hindu friend visiting us, and the conversation started in a very simple way. And he said, what is your daughter's name? And we have given her a name, Shruti. Shruti means, actually it comes from the Sanskrit word, revelation through hearing, or today musical note. It's a pure Sanskrit word. And he just took back and he said, what are you trying to do? I said, this is part of Indian heritage, we want to keep it. Please don't tell me, I'm a Hindu. And just by adopting some of these things, you are not going to tell us that you are changed. For us, you still remain. He is a good friend of mine, so he could share. He said, you are trouble with Christians. No, you want to do, no, you don't want to do things straight. See, he is citing the example of Muslims. And they are very clear about that identity, and they do the things as it is done in Arab, and they don't feel shy because their name is Muhammad or Ahmad. But you are shy, your name is Henry Wilson, and you will never give a English name to your daughter. This is another thing, and it was quite a bit of... here we are really struggling, Indian Christians are struggling with a great sense of identity. And some of our theologians have sorted it out, saying we are Indian hyphenated Christians. Both traditions go with that. But for a Hindu, after hyphenation, when the Christian comes, that is much more important for him than the first part of it. I think that is the... So I don't know... I don't know how we are going to develop our own indigenization.
Would the people's theology taking some leadership in this whole critical area?
Yeah. See, they are very critical. See, I am also personally very critical of these kind of things. But now, I think only way out is pick up what is there in the people, which has not already been the culture of the Brahmins and dominant class. Then we can always say, and we have the rightful place because 70 to 80% of our people come from there. But since people are not sure about this, many of our educated class and other people, they tend to keep this what they are, we have inherited from England and other places. And that's what we keep on telling them. Even in England they have changed. But
Henry, let me ask a question another way. How do you see the use of the people's theology breaking through some of the dehumanizing factors which are present in that caste class system? You talked about the key being the question of one's humanity and liberation for the sense of humanity. What do you see are some of our earlier conversations about Indian Jesus out of those things we've done before? Where do you see the most provocative and distinct contributions?
I think,
and I guess the second question may not be related, to whether there is more of a tie with the Minyum theology in the Asian context as over against the, is there more parallel there as over against perhaps the liberation theology?
I think one of the great service people's theology is doing is bringing us the new possibility of looking at the so-called unchangeable concepts which you have inherited or developed. Whole new approach to thinking of God now, expressing God, seeing Jesus, the whole new understanding of salvation, the whole new understanding of relations. No, to give a simple example, like, so when churches are discussing for hours and hours together and voting about whether women should be ordained and all that, these things just doesn't bother them. You see, women also equally come and they dance and they beat the drums and they also participate equally and they're part of the whole drama. You know, the whole approach is, you know, this kind of barriers which we thought we couldn't break and which in case didn't affect the upper class people but kept in subjugation these 80% of people. Mm-hmm. So these people's theology is trying to break. Now, of course, places like United Theological College and our systematic professor, they think this is all rubbish, you see, because there's no, it is not systematically presented. But I think it's a great challenge. But I'll tell you again, it's not a mass movement, it's very much in the fringe. And we had a consultation about emerging theologies in India, a book will come out. It's organized by Christian Conference of Asia. It is called Sun and Lotus. Mm-hmm. Sun in the VRC, lotus is the, it is a national flower and symbol. So lotus represents all people, no, it's not, and sun is breaking through in a sense of new dawn, it's a new era is coming up. And some of the people are very, some of the theologians like M.M. Thomas and Samuel Ryan, mm-hmm. And there are quite a number of people who are thinking the direction. I think we made a start, but from here, where we'll go, then whether it will also influence the whole other areas eventually when it develops. See, two natures of Christ. Now we simply adopt. Now people say, now we have to write our own creed, Apostles' Creed, and Nicene Creed has its own oppressive way of doing it. Or the whole understanding of Trinity. All these things will eventually come, but the approach will be different than what has been done so far.
Thank you.